You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word and Sports Incorporated, Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scars. We are coming to you on the evening of Monday, March 11, 2019. We've got a great show for you tonight, recapping a whole bunch of big picture MLS stuff and looking ahead to the next weekend, including CCL games midweek. My good friend Daniel Sperry. Dan, how did you enjoy Sporting getting back in the winning column against Philadelphia Union?
Yeah, it was a good time out at the old Children's Mercy Park. Good atmosphere. The TIFO, if I don't know if you've seen it yet, but the big one of the songs that the Cauldron sings, the "We're all part of Hermes Army, we're all out to win the league, and we don't give a blank whoever you may be, because we are," something like that. But they've got this whole chant around they're the Vermes Army kind of a thing. So it is massive TIFO that covered the entire top span of where they usually hang the batter or hang the banner, not batter, hang banner, that says, welcome to the blue hell. So yeah, that was really awesome. And the atmosphere was great. A relatively entertaining game to watch. I mean, Philly was interesting in terms of pressing high and stuff like that. Of course, we'll dive into the match too much right away, but, you know, it was a interesting little battle there. I know Sporting, you know, you have Gianluca Busio in the middle too. And that was a lot of fun, to see him play and him just look like a seasoned veteran, and he's freaking 16 years old. So that was pretty cool. You know, he was in the middle of a lot of the action. He did a lot of really good defensive recovery too, which I think was something that not a lot of people see in his game. So, those are quick thoughts, but I have, and I put that in my article at the end of the match as well. But overall, it was good for Sporting Kansas City to virtually sleepwalk and get all 3 points ahead of one of the best games. I mean, Vermees admitted they weren't at their best. They didn't look as sharp. The off-the-ball movement wasn't as sharp. They didn't move the ball as quickly, and they still handled Philadelphia pretty well. I know Philadelphia is good at creating chances without having the majority of the ball, but they're terrible at finishing. We'll discuss why later, but you know, overall props to Sporting Kansas City for getting 3 points in a home opener and doing it pretty easily and without exerting a whole lot of effort as well.
Excellent stuff, Dan. I had my first, I would say, of 2019, my first really good just sports day of just sitting in and just, you know, ODing on MLS, MLS Live on ESPN Plus, and I got to watch some of all the games. It was really, really nice. Went skiing yesterday at Winter Park, so I missed some of the earlier nationally televised game. Had a pretty rough one watching the Rapids lose again to the Seattle Sounders, but, you know, a bunch of injured center backs. I'm not sure that Danny Wilson and Declan Wynn are going to be starters once everybody's healthy. You know, Tommy Smith, Courtney Ford, Axel Schuberg, who was suspended for that red card in Snow Classico 3, were not there. And I still think the midfield just absolutely looked like a disaster in terms of positioning and arrangements. And, you know, granted, those are, you know, Jack Price is the most veteran member of that four-man midfield trying to play diamond total football. And, you know, he was with the club, you know, maybe, what, 14 months ago when he officially signed. Benny Fellhaber and Nicholas Mosqueda, you know, were both offseason additions. And Kellen Acosta has been with the club, what, he came in July or August, I believe. So he's been with the club, what, 8 or 9 months now. So they still have some work to do. And, you know, losing to a Sounders team that has a lot of really good offensive firepower and is very well versed in what they're trying to play, you know, on turf at the Clink in front of 40,000 people, not something easy to do. For those of you who want to laugh, folks, go check out the comment sections of Matt Pence's tweet from yesterday regarding the Rapids fan support and just the level of how we choose to evaluate or how we choose to judge away support and taking that as a barometer of interest in the team versus some of the other factors that are in play. It was interesting. I'll let Rapids Twitter speak for itself. I choose to not get too far into the weeds, but Dan, let's get to it. We've got a lot of really big topic things to talk about rather than individual games. You know, with the point between CCL and preseason, we can start to look at least some trends or at least project on things that we've started to notice that might be a concern or something to look for in the future. And let's start with the absolute chaos happening in Orlando or happening in Atlanta, or shall I say Atlanta Twitter right now. Atlanta United gets a 1-1 draw against FC Cincinnati after scoring just 5 minutes into the game. Dominating possession, but not really creating a whole lot of chances after scoring that goal. And Atlanta now has just one win in five competitive games in 2019, and that was at home against a Herediano team that, you know, I think talent-wise, they were far superior to. Other than that, it's been two road losses to CCL, a pretty lackluster performance against DC United, who trounced them 2-1. And then, you know, I would almost call yesterday's 1-1 draw a FC Cincinnati win over Atlanta. And let's start with Frank DeBoer's comments after getting booed. And then, of course, the Twitter account that has been DeBoer out because, of course, you lose your first game against, you know, against Herediano. Then, of course, you have to fire the manager. Frank DeBoer on criticism and how it is being weighed on him. This was in the context of Atlanta fans at Mercedes-Benz Stadium booing Atlanta after the match ended 1-1. Quote, they were a little bit spoiled with the results last year. Everybody expected that, and that all, and thinks that's also normal. But everybody also saw what happened with Toronto when they played Champions League last season. He went on to comment that, you know, things are still in development, and, you know, one individual game, one bad performance, or I say one bad result given the performance, does not make an MLS team. And look, MLS is chaos. Like, Dan, like, you could tell me that San Jose Earthquakes are going to go to Sporting Kansas City and get a red card 2 minutes in and a Wando PK and walk out of there 4-0. And I'm like, that's not completely out of the realm of possibility. How are you making sense of Atlanta right now? Is this way too much pandemonium and drama from a relatively new fan base in MLS? And I guess more importantly, where do they go from here? Because they've got a lot of work to do in the 3-4-3.
Yeah, I don't think the system suits them at all. I mean, I think the idea of putting, I don't know, there's just a whole lot of like question marks that I have there with how he's choosing to employ them. I think this team with its current setup is probably better suited for some sort of a 4-3-3. But we'll see. So there's a lot of questions I have. I don't mind Barco on the wing, but PD Martinez is getting absolutely lost on the wide side of things. Martinez played more as kind of a free roaming player, a striker duo, or, you know, a singular striker. He had much more of a free role with River Plate, which is something that he hasn't had so much with DeBoer in Atlanta. And I think, you know, why Almirón was so good, because he was central, and he was the guy that you said, if you're going to pay the money for this guy, you're going to give the keys to the offense to this guy. And right now, it's a whole lot of trying to get service to Martinez, but he's up there all alone. And I think they need to, I would like to see them do some sort of a 4-3-1-2 or a 4-3-3 that allows or even a 3-4-1-2 kind of a thing, to have somebody underneath underneath Joseph Martinez, like Petey, you know, to kind of do it. But I think DeBoer's kind of got him. He's gone away from, you know, he sits there and what he's wanting to do is to play his system. But what I don't think he realizes is that there's already a system in place that he needs to go through that. I think some on Twitter were kind of arguing. I think Jeff Reuter from The Athletic was one that pointed it out, is that he'd be a really good coach for a team that's just trying to build something. But the problem is Atlanta has everything already. So now they need the guy to go in and put the guys in the right places. And that's not always been DeBoer's strength. It has been the quote unquote system. And if you're going to go into a situation like that, it better be a situation that needs a system. Atlanta doesn't need a system. They've got the players that can outdo any system. They need to have a coach that puts them in the position to succeed. I don't think he's doing that. And I think that's why Atlanta fans are upset. Cause you know, your question, you paid $20 million and you've got Petey Martinez just getting hacked down in the wing. just trying to send crosses in to Joseph Martinez. And that's his entire game. He doesn't get a chance to take the ball, turn it, run at defenders, which is something he does well, something, a chance to combine, underneath Joseph Martinez, which is something that he did really well with River Plate. So, I understand the Atlanta fans' frustrations, but at the same time, it's a new coach. He's got a chance to figure things out. And to lose a player, the quality of Almiron, and you can pay so much for PD Martinez, but you're not going to get Miguel Almiron out of PD Martinez. It's an entirely different animal, and really an entirely different kind of player. And that is going to be an adjustment for everybody else, because the entire Atlanta system was built off of Almiron running the running everything, and then just having talented wingers and forwards making runs off of him that he can pick out that ball, and that's no longer there. So Atlanta United has to have time to get used to it. And then on top of it, Rome wasn't built in a day, and I think that's the thing that Atlanta fans need to have some patience with, and at times it's going to cost results. I think that's what Frank DeBoer was trying to say. But at the same time, considering the situation, it did not sound good at all. I think that's, and considering Frank DeBoer's history, it did not sound good at all. So I also understand Atlanta fans' frustrations in here. Is, you know, DeBoer, I think, isn't getting the best out of everything. And I think he's still trying to figure it out. And I think Atlanta's still trying to figure it out. The fans are starting to get impatient. And it's kind of an interesting situation, maybe one that I don't think we've ever been in MLS, to have a high profile manager like that have such, already with a fan base, have such a short leash, especially with the type of quality that they have. I'm just trying to think of, you know, someone that has had that's come in, and in less than 100 days, his job security is already being questioned by the fan base and whether or not he should be there. That's kind of unprecedented in MLS. And if Atlanta wants to be a first for everything, or be, you know, at the forefront of everything, I mean, I might as well be at the forefront of instituting the Real Madrid precedent for MLS, right?
Yeah, no, I think there's a couple of variables coming in here. And I guess I'll start off by saying, Dan, that I was cautiously optimistic about this signing, or I guess the coaching hire, rather. But some of the things about it didn't really make sense to me, or there were dots that I didn't immediately connect. You know, you had a primarily Central and South American team that had that kind of flair, that played that style of soccer. So I thought it was pretty much made sense that they were going to go out and get somebody else, you know, of that type, or at the very least in the general schema, or someone you could say would potentially have been in the coaching tree of Tata Martino. And look, obviously they were rumored with Guillermo Barros-Skelotto, and you know, there was banter and commentary out there saying that he wasn't a good fit from a style of play, even though obviously there was a cultural and a language similarity there, and ultimately he went to the LA Galaxy. Okay, fine. You didn't want him, you didn't want Matias Almeida or somebody else. You know, there wasn't another Brazilian, Argentine, Chilean coach that you potentially would have gone after. Maybe somebody in Liga MX, now that, you know, Atlanta maybe had, you know, was on the map in terms of the general CONCACAF space, to where you could have gotten, I'm just throwing out a name here, for example, Tuca Ferretti, for example, or, you know, Miguel Herrera or something like that. You know, you could have gone out and gotten one of those names, or gotten a guy who was a cultural fit. So I think culture is one thing, that this team was used to playing a very distinct style of play, and they very much looked like a Central and South American team. Like, if you told me, you know, if you took away the jerseys and you took away who they were playing and the names on the back, and you just made them generic, and you took away the stadium and you said how they play, and you were like, hey, Matt, like, do you think this could be River Plate? Or, you know, could this be, I think Municipal is the big super club in Santiago, Chile? I would have said, yeah, like, they've got a lot of similarities, and I would have described the prototypical false number nine that was Joseph Martinez, and sort of the running gun number 10 that was Miguel Almiron. And I might not know their names, but I would have been able to identify that team for a particular continent on the planet as related to world football. And now they're playing more of a Dutch system in a, you know, a 3-4-3 that can become a 4-3-3 at times. And it just feels like everybody's being forced into a box, and really outside of the back line and Jeff Lorenowitz, nobody's really being put in a position to succeed. Joseph Martinez is kind of being stretched to do things that he's not completely comfortable with. Nobody's really gotten in the space between the midfield and the and the back line of the opponent, and then the midfield's just completely jumbled up. I completely agree with the comments during yesterday's game. I want to say, I think it was Taylor Twellman, but I'm not sure, who said that, you know, Eric Rometty just looked like a complete fish out of water. Yes, you brought in Breck Shea, who has some fantastic moments, but it can also be extremely inconsistent. Am I really that surprised that he didn't look great in CCL, and then playing in a fifth game in 17 days, you know, was rather flat against Cincinnati? So I think there's some systematic problems that, I guess, just going back to whatever interview conversation Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra had with Frank DeBoer, when you showed him his team and you thought, you know, what would you do with this team if we end up hiring you? Like, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation, just because it just seems like a bunch of square pegs and round holes. And other than the swap for Almiron for PT Martinez, it just doesn't really seem like they made enough changes for this to be DeBoer's team. This is very clearly Frank DeBoer trying to take Tata Martino's team and turn them into his team. And if you have that drastic of a change in personnel, you either have to have personnel who are flexible to where somebody can do a different role. That's clearly not the case. Or you've got to make some actual player changes. And outside of the mechanisms available in MLS with Greg Garza, you know, getting transferred to the expansion team and a few other small moves they made, and of course Almiron wanting to go to Europe, they didn't really make any changes. This isn't Frank DeBoer's team from a personnel standpoint. And then going back to the other thing that I was saying to finish off the first point about culture is, now you've got a language barrier, you know, where Tata Martino was speaking, you know, was had, I don't want, Tata Martino's English is better than my Spanish has ever been, and will probably be better than any secondary language that I speak, you know, as a, you know, as a white American. So he spoke broken English enough to where there was communication with the non-Spanish speakers. And, you know, I think half the roster is fluent in Spanish or natively fluent in Spanish. So if there was any issues, they could really translate relatively easily. Now, potentially, you've got Frank DeBoer going from speaking Dutch to translating to English. And then that, in some cases, has to get translated into Spanish. I'm wondering how much is lost in translation and having to go through those three languages, and then how much just culturally is different given how Frank DeBoer runs things and his approach to the game that is very Dutch compared to what's going on the other, you know, on the other side. The last thing that I'll say, you know, I'll finish up this rant, is, you know, for the first time in 2019, Atlanta United are officially the hunted. You know, they anointed themselves MLS Cup champions. You saw, fairly or unfairly, the you know, backlash from other MLS pundits, people in other markets, fans of other teams, in terms of how the Atlanta fan base approached that team and approached the playoffs and celebrated themselves, and what some would argue would be a club being born on third base and acting like they hit a triple and then stole home plate like Jackie Robinson in the World Series. You know, that's coming, you know, those proverbial chickens, perceived or actual, are coming home to roost. And the fact is, as MLS Cup champions with that gold star above your crest, everybody's going to be coming after you. You are going to get everybody's A game. Every single team in the Eastern Conference, and I'd say most in the Western Conference, are circling the date on their calendar that they're playing you. So you combine with winning the game, with winning MLS Cup and everything, and maybe you've got 1-2% more complacency. And then you combine that with another, with the opponent being 1-2% more motivated to defeat you. And then you combine with all the other internal discontinuities that they've got going on, or at the very least they're trying to work out, you know, that's going to lead to some growing pains. And now Atlanta United, to the club, you for the first time are now facing adversity, as every single MLS Cup champion has, as Toronto FC faced last year, as the LA Galaxy did, in the first year of Kurt Arnolfo, of you used to being the big bad guy on the block and then now having none of your fancy expensive DPs and then a bunch of young players who weren't ready to go, and now you're getting punched in the mouth and now you've got to do something about it. Dan, I've ranted enough. You know, if we put this one to bed, you know, on a scale of, let's do DEFCON ratings, 5 being not worried at all, DEFCON 1 being, you know, the Atlanta United soccer equivalent of Cold War mutually assured destruction, where should Atlanta United supporters listening to this right now be at?
DEFCON 2. DEFCON 2? Really. There's 32 games left in the MLS regular season. Your Champions League campaign is likely coming to an end, so you're not going to deal with any non-MLS fixtures until US Open Cup, and even then Atlanta never takes it seriously and they seem to lose in the round of 16, or at least the quarterfinals, kind of a thing. So we'll see. I just there's 2 games in MLS so far And they have, I believe, what they won the first one, right? So, 1 point. Did they win on? Wait.
No, they lost. They have 1 point. They have 1 point in two MLS games.
Okay, so they drew, and then they lost their first MLS game. Who did they play in the first one?
Oh, DC. They were at DC United.
Duh. Okay, there we go. Sorry. There's been so much soccer and so much stuff in the last, like, week and a half that I'm, like, all my dates are blurring together here. Yeah, so DEFCON 2, there's just so much time left. You have 32 chances to get it right. I mean, there's... I with the quality that they have, with the ability that they have, I just don't be worried yet. It was always going to be an uphill task. They took care of Herediano pretty easily in that second leg. Herediano traditionally is a very tough win away from home. Any MLS team going down to Costa Rica knows it's a mess down there. Not a mess, but like it is a difficult place to go play in either Saprissa, Herediano, there's a couple other Costa Rican teams that are quite good, that are very difficult to go and play. So, you know, I don't hold that road result against them because they came back in the second leg and smashed Herediano and looked good doing it. They lose against DC United, who's very good at home. Nasty, rainy surface. That chance from Guzan. So, okay, Guzan lets one in there. And another kind of deflected one at the back post. I mean, you're at two points, maybe 1 point out of it. I mean, they're fair results. They got what they deserved out of them, but it is just way too early for me to be just smashing the panic button, and thinking, wow, this is DEFCON 3, 4, 5. Like, wait, sorry. Did I get this wrong?
Yeah, you got it wrong. DEFCON 1, everything's fine. DEFCON 5, everything's fine.
Okay, so DEFCON 4.
DEFCON 4. Okay.
Don't worry about editing that. Just let it roll because I'm okay sounding stupid as heck. But like DEFCON 4 is definitely where I'm at.
Okay, I agree with you. You know, if we just go with just the results and everything. Okay, you didn't like the first leg, but ultimately you got through. I think you would have expected Atlanta United to beat Herediano. MLS precedent, especially MLS teams in their first time in Champions League together with a new manager and the best player gone in the offseason, you're pretty much expecting them to lose regardless of how bad it looks to the first Mexican team you play in Champions League. So the loss
especially
is really
Monterrey.
A surprise, especially Monterrey. And so, I mean, you know, if you end up losing, you know, if it ends up being 4-2 on aggregate, you know, I think that's not that bad, all things considered. And then DC United has Atlanta's number. DC United is really good at home at Audi Field, and they were coming off of playing a game at altitude 3 days prior. Like, are you really surprised that the one bogey team for Atlanta United beat them when you were on the road, didn't rotate your squad, and had to play a game in another country 3 days prior? So the only result of the five they've had so far for me is the draw to FC Cincinnati. It's way too early. They could easily figure things out. I believe in DeBoer's competency, even though I still have some doubts about whether or not his system works, but something is going to have to tweak. Something is going to have to change. You have 32 games to figure that out. You know, like, go back, you know, Atlanta fans who didn't pay attention to MLS prior to 2 years ago, go back and look at the 2014 Seattle Sounders, results map and everything and see all the red L's in the first half of the season. And they still made it to the playoffs and won MLS Cup. There's still plenty to work on. Y'all are panicking because you won MLS Cup last year and you're expecting it to be easy. Welcome to soccer for 90% of the world. Let's move on, Dan. Philadelphia Union have not had a good start to their MLS play. Meanwhile, CJ Sapong has 2 goals in 2 games. You asked the question, so you posed the question in our doc organizing the show. So for the rundown, I'll throw it to you. Did Philadelphia Union trade the wrong striker? How has he impacted Chicago Fire? And what's going on with Philly's offense other than Marco Fabian getting red cards?
Yeah, I mean, Sapong's been good for the offense in Chicago. He's helped. Like, Chicago really should have won that game. Nemanja Nikolic missed a couple of wide open chances in the box. You know, everyone's sitting there like, oh, Orlando doesn't look half bad. Really, the Chicago Fire, who are not good, should have won that game like 3-1, 4-1, maybe. You know, and they get the red card in there. Just a whole lot of Chicago Fire. I mean, that's why they are the Chicago Fire, right? They should have won the game 3-1, and they didn't. But Sapong has looked good in terms of creating chances for Nikolic. My money's on Nikolic at some point getting around and actually finishing off a couple of those chances in the game. I'm not saying, oh, Chicago, look at them, but like, it's Orlando, but he's, you know, they've created chances. Sapong has two goals for them, two games. And a lot of it has done by the stuff that he is good at. And I look at the two strikers that Philadelphia is employing and Fabian underneath, Corey Burke and, Fafa Picole, who, you know, Picole's probably just as good as a wing. I'd prefer him as a winger than I would a striker. But they're trying to use his pace, to help the pressing and the transition play, and the counterattacking out of it. So, I understand that. Marco Fabian needs to be much better for them, but right now they have the highest, I believe, out of these last couple of games, they have like the highest expected goals rate in MLS, and they have one goal, out of two penalty kicks too. And they have no goals from the open run of play. There's a wonderful link up play that they had in the box about 10 minutes into the game. It's actually like a couple minutes before the penalty, to Sporting Kansas City within the first 10 minutes there. And, excuse me. There was a ball that was sent to Crivell out wide, and he backheeled it into Marco Fabian, who was just standing between the, you know, unmarked, a bad mistake by the Sporting KC back line. Fabian finds that crease in that space inside the box, which is what he's good at, and he just absolutely missed the goal. Multiple times, headers at, you know, chances. You know, they had a bunch of shots on target, but so many of them were so tame for Tim Melia to take care of. And if you put a tame effort out there, Tim Melia is going to get it. Like his mistakes are so rare and few and far between that, like, you know, just sending a wide open shot from 30 yards out, that goes straight to him and bounces once, you know, a couple, 10 yards in front of him. He knows where it's going to go. He'll be right there and he'll swallow it up. So I sit there and I look at Philadelphia and all the chances that they've created. And there's so many chances that they had in the game yesterday, and in the first game, because I've watched every single minute that Philadelphia has played this year, because I watched that first game, all the way through. And there's so many chances that they have had that if CJ Sapong was there, I'm sure he would have finished it off. And I think that's the thing that you sit there, and that's my question. That's why I raise it. Did Philadelphia trade the wrong striker? And that's a question that, I think Philadelphia fans and writers maybe should start asking. Of course, all the attention was on Fabian for missing the peak. The first player in MLS history since Eric Avila with Chivas USA to both miss a penalty kick or have a penalty kick saved, and receive a straight red card in the same game. So, great Paul Carr nugget, the great Paul Carr, formerly of ESPN, stats guru there, pulled that one up for us on Sunday. So, Fabian, you'd like to see him finish better, in those chances, but they've had a lot of chances and a lot of bad finishes. And it leads that question. I think right now it's maybe too early to answer it because maybe they'll come around and get used to a new system that they've, said that this is Ernst Tanner has come in and said, this is the way we're going to play. But at the same time, like you sit there and you question, you're like, man, should they have not traded, you know, should they have maybe cashed in on Corey Burke or Picot, and kept Sapong in there? Cause Sapong scores goals, 2-2. So, it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, Dan. Like with my comments on Atlanta, I think it's way too early to tell. And obviously you have a team, that's very much, you know, learning a new style of play under a new technical director. I don't remember what Tanner's official title is, you know, the one where he's making player decisions and Jim Curtin's boss. So I think that's a little bit too early. I guess the one thing that I'll say is, you know, if I were to have a Venn diagram of what all three of their strikers were last year, Corey Burke, Papa Pico, CJ Sapong, I would say that of those three, the Corey Burke and Pico overlap the most. There's a lot of things that CJ Sapong does that CJ Sapong does really well that neither of the other two are good at, or neither of the other two do well. As we've seen with this time in Chicago, you know, with Chicago Fire, you know, a bit of a poacher's going, you know, taking advantage of an opportunity and rounding a keeper with a really nice finish and then a really good header goal as well. So I think CJ Sapong is a good complement to Nemanja Nikolić. and that he'll be a little bit more physical. He'll be a little bit more of an aerial threat. And obviously he brings something new to Chicago's offense that they, other than Alan Gordon, they didn't really have last year at all. And he brings something that he, I think, is going to make other people better because he's going to occupy space. You don't really have that with the either of the other two. Granted, when you're pressing, you don't really need a true number nine, you know, 6'2", 6'3". So I understand why they made that decision, but CJ Sapong's definitely doing something that, you know, if you're talking about the variety of weapons that Jim Curtin has on, you know, his union soccer coach Batman utility belt, you know, he's limited in terms of his offensive options because he doesn't have that pure number nine. Now, they have created a lot of chances. I'm not sure I had faith in any one of their three strikers, to be honest, but I do think that they have a little bit. I do think that they need to take a little bit more time adjusting to it. I guess my bigger question, similar to Atlanta, is more in the macro scale of, is this a system that works for the team? You know, how is this being played out psychologically within the locker room, you know, in whispers or just in anybody's individual heads or outright talking about it? The fact that Jim Curtin came back in a 1-year contract and it was basically Ernst Tanner giving him, you know, a 1-year trial, for lack of a better term, to say, you know, are you actually going to be my coach or am I going to bring in one of my guys, given that you're not a pressing coach and, you know, you were a coach that was held over from the previous regime in Ernie Stewart, who's coming to the U.S. men's national team. So my bigger question is, do the Philadelphia Union believe in this system or not? Do they believe in the personnel that they have? And are they confident in, you know, the next 5 to 6 weeks that they're going to figure things out, that their chances created are going to lead to goals, and that Marco Fabiano is going to have, you know, a slightly healthier adjustment to MLS? If the answer to that question is yes, or if we believe it, or we see what's going wrong and we have immediate answers to fix it that we're working on right now, then I'm fine with it. If they're immediately thinking maybe we don't have the right personnel, you know, the window's closing and you got to do something, and I think maybe in hindsight, for the sake of learning from your mistakes, you do need to rethink the trade that you made with Chicago Fire. If nothing else, maybe looking at the transfer fee to see what other assets you could have gotten out of that situation that would have been healthy for you. Let's move on to some happy things in the Western Conference, Dan. Minnesota United have 2 road wins in 2 games this season, and both of those wins came against Western Conference opponents last year, and 2 teams that finished above them, or not the San Jose Earthquakes did not finish above them. But in any case, Minnesota United has 2 road wins, 2 road wins against Western Conference teams, something that did not happen prior to this year starting, and they've done it looking really, really good and scoring a whole bunch of goals, and they got a shutout against the San Jose Earthquakes. Darwin Quintero looks great. Miguel Ibarra looks great. And, you know, Adrian Heath is saying, you know, we finally have a good team and a team that I think should make the playoffs. Happy loons, yes?
Yeah, you should be. Especially, I mean, you can sit there and you can complain about, or I guess you can say the Earthquakes didn't finish above them, but the Earthquakes beat them both times they played them last year. 2 of the Earthquakes' 4 wins were the loons. So that's pretty bad in and of itself. The loons are very good, actually. And I figured they would be coming into this season. I figured they would be a playoff team. I put them in the playoffs in my predictions and they're proving me right. Granted, they've played 2 bad teams. Vancouver's not very good. San Jose is not very good. I expect, you know, the 3-0 win. If Minnesota United is a playoff team, they should have gone into San Jose and shellacked them 3-0 because the Earthquakes are not good. They should have gone into Vancouver and gotten a result. Vancouver's a little bit better than San Jose, I think, but they're not that good. So, you know, they go in and they get the result. A couple of helter-skelter moments. You're playing on turf on the road in Canada, home opener for Vancouver. Okay, fine. I guess you can chalk up those 2 goals as a whatever kind of a thing, but I think you're probably going to see something close to the 3-0 loons as long as their midfield tandem of Grigish and Ozzie Alonso are healthy, that defensive midfielder's tandem, and then as long as Aiko Parra is healthy too. Those 3 additions there in the middle of the park have absolutely set everything else alight or Minnesota United. And it's a shame they don't have Christian Martinez up front in their roster scoring goals for them, because if they had Christian Martinez up top, this team is shoe-in playoff team. Ibarra creating, Quintero underneath, a number 9. You know, you've got another, I forget who plays on the right wing for him, but they've got plenty of options. They also have Kevin Molino, who's in the squad somewhere. You know, there's options with this team, and I think you're seeing well, if you're, like I said, if you are expecting Minnesota United to be a playoff team in 2019, and if Minnesota United supporters are expecting them to try and be a playoff team in 2019, those are the results you get. You don't go lose 3-2. You don't lose at home to the Earthquakes when the Earthquakes are god-awful. That you don't do that if you're a playoff team. And the playoff teams last year did not do that. So a massive step forward for Minnesota United. You've seen really good things from, I think, the second game against the Earthquakes. Again, Earthquakes are bad. But Ozzie Alonso was awesome in the midfield. Go look at his passing map over his first two games with them all over the place. You see Ozzie doing flashback Ozzie things, and that is really cool. And if he can sustain that, he can stay healthy. You know, him and Gregers doing the defensive work in the middle of the field allows Darwin Quintero to just roam, not have to worry about tracking back and playing defense, and he can just roam and pick up balls in space and turn and go and run at people and play in others and score goals and look fantastic, because that he is like, you know, we sit there and we say, okay, maybe who's going to be kind of the next Giovinco type. Darwin Quintero is probably the closest thing to a Giovinco type in MLS now that Giovinco's gone, in terms of that type of player who is just literally all over the place. And every time he picks up the ball, something can happen. Quintero's been fantastic all season long, or these last two games, but into last year. I mean, last year he was fantastic with Minnesota United, and there wasn't, you know, I didn't think there was at one point with them that there was a down spot, for Quintero at least. Himself. So, you know, he's a good finisher. He's got immense talent on the ball and smarts off the ball to pick up the space. And I think you're seeing Minnesota kind of take care of business early, as they should if you are expecting them to be a playoff team. And I think they're kind of proving where they stand within the Western Conference right now.
I think that there's a very good possibility that the San Jose Earthquakes and the Vancouver Whitecaps are 1-2, or I should say 12-11 in the Western Conference in 2019. I definitely don't have them making the playoffs, and I think they'll be below the red line by a comfortable margin in terms of points between the last team to get in and where they're at. But I think the big thing right now for Minnesota is this is confidence builders. You know, they went out and they got two road wins against two, you know, six pointers in the context of playing a conference opponent that they did not get last year. And while this is something that I would have faith in that most other playoff teams in MLS would go to San Jose and probably beat the San Jose Earthquakes and probably beat and get a result against the Vancouver Whitecaps, this is something Minnesota hasn't done in the past. So if you were on Minnesota's team last year, you were thinking, this is different. We are different than what we were last year. I have confidence in that. If you're Aiko Parra or Ozzie Alonso coming in and thinking, you know, I think I'm going to come in and be the difference, but I don't know about these other guys, or I've seen how it's gone before. You're looking at this and thinking, you're buying into this, thinking, okay, they figured it out, they've gotten it right, and I am part of why those results are getting different. And we have a very, very good track record, Dan, of pretty much every single time an MLS team opens up a new stadium, particularly when they start off on the road for a good bit, and then open it midway through the season, have a bunch of home games backloaded, not a whole lot of travel, fans really, really excited, packing the stadium week after week, providing that atmosphere, being that 12th man, that those teams normally do well once that happens, and they roll that into the playoffs. We saw it with DC United last year opening up Audi Field. Not with the San Jose Earthquakes. Who's another really good example of that off the top of my head? We saw that, I guess Atlanta put an asterisk on that because Bobby Dodd was huge, and then Mercedes-Benz was also, you know, really, really big. But I've got faith that Minnesota United is going to be a good home team. And if these are, just, you know, 6 points that maybe they wouldn't have gotten last year, that might be the difference in terms of them jumping closer. And if they're going into opening Allianz Field thinking, we're feeling confident about this, we're feeling better about ourselves, we're playing good soccer on the road at stadiums we would have lost to last year, they're going to be even better at home. So if nothing else from a confidence standpoint, I think these 6 points might lead to a couple of games when they open up at home against really good teams, a draw turns into a win. A win turns into a win by a couple more goals that helps to pad their goal differential. So I don't know whether or not this is, you know, I don't know that I'm buying stock in those two games or how much I take out of the actual results, but if you're in that locker room, if you're Adrian Heath right now, if you're one of the new players, if you're one of the fans, you have to be feeling better about yourself. And that's a way healthier mindset to be in than this team normally has been after starting the season out really, really bad, particularly on the road. Let's move on to, we're going from, east to west in this one. Let's move out to our, to Southern California for our final big topic of the night, Dan. San Jose Earthquake, or not San Jose Earthquakes, excuse me, Los Angeles Football Club have two wins at home. Very convincing, very good play. Carlos Vela's playing fantastically, and they've done it against two teams that made the playoffs and were in the Western Conference Final last year. I mean, is LAFC going 34-0 and hosting and winning MLS Cup?
I don't know. It'd be fun. I don't know if they'll go 34-0. I don't even know if there's. I don't know if there's any
33-1 because Zlatan.
I don't know if, well, that too, but like, I don't know if there's ever like, is MLS at like, as top heavy enough yet to like an Invincibles team? I don't think we'll ever see that, in an MLS, or I don't think we will see it. I would put money down that we will not see an Invincibles MLS team, within the next 30 years until the parity has a chance to fully kind of go away and the landscape changes to where you really have a firm stronghold at the top and a firm and a pretty clear cut, gap in ability from, you know, even the mid tier down, to the very bottom. But, no, I think LAFC is great. I don't know. They're right now, they're my favorite for, I mean, I said preseason predictions. Yes, yes, yes. But right now they look like the closest team to being a strong shield contender. Granted, you know, they could be sitting out of this first game, this, you know, these first two games of 4 points. If maybe Roger Espinoza doesn't get sent off or, you know, somebody picks up, you know, somebody steps up and picks up his man in space. So Adama Diomande isn't waltzing into the box and just ripping one in the top corner onto Emilia. I mean, the conversation around all of it could be different. But there's no denying the fact that they absolutely shellacked Portland, which a lot of people still think will have a chance in the West. I think their age is starting to show. They didn't do much to help the back line. Cascante wasn't great with his positioning, at times. And so you're looking at this with Portland and, it's not a great team. We'll see though. I think LAFC are still a strong team. They're still up there for me in the Western Conference. I'd say let's maybe like pump the brakes a little bit on, you know, Shield talk and best team in MLS. Are they going to pull Atlanta United? LAFC still have their flaws. And then against a team with a, you know, Portland almost caught them at times. If they had a little bit better, Ibo Bisse finished his chance great, but you know, let's say they did get a Bardo Vargas up there, they may have had another goal or two. But you know, I think Portland still has its issues to work out, down to a man. And then at the end of it, the back line was just all out of shape, and positioning wise, and that back line still without Liam Ridgewell now for the first time in about 4 or 5 years. I think that's going to cause a lot of, I'll say issues for them, but issues for them because it will be. I don't think it's a long-term issue. I think it'll be an issue of just kind of figuring it out. But, you know, LAFC, enough talk about Portland. I mean, LAFC took care of business on Sunday night. The home atmosphere was great. You know, the 3252 is one of my favorite supporters groups in MLS just because what they do is crazy and it's loud and it's all like the whole giant section is choreographed and it's, there's not a lot of groups that look like that. So, you know, I think LAFC is going to be a lot of fun throughout the year. If Carlos Vela keeps up this kind of form, that'd be incredible. He was my pick for player of the week this year. My voting went, I don't like to be like, oh, this guy, he's the star guy. He scored a goal and had an assist. So we'll vote him player of the week. Don't like to do that as much, but three assists and a goal. And he probably could have had more on either side of it. I think Carlos Vela, could end up, you know, with an MVP type track record and he easily deserved player of the week this week. So, you know, props to him. Kudos. And I think what'll be more interesting to see is does he stay healthy? Cause he does have a bit of an injury history throughout his career. So does he stay healthy? And if he's not healthy, what does LAFC do? I think that's the only question for their shield race. But I think they're going to be in the thick of it in the shield race. I think they're going to be thick of it at the top of the Western Conference. And they're just kind of proving that, throughout this first half here or his first couple games at least. So, props to them for their strong start. And, right now they look like the team to beat in MLS.
Took all my talking points, Dan, so let's move on to the round table. We'll start off with rapid fire. You mentioned Diego Chara getting the red card, Dan. We've seen some, I have noticed a few trends since the implementation of VAR and in the methodology and the evolution of pro and their approach to officiating games. We've seen there's existing precedent going back to, you know, a couple of years ago that we saw come in week one when Philadelphia Union had that handball called against them, even though it appeared that the defender, that it went off the back of his shoulder blade. You had Axel Schuberg, get a red card in Snow Classico 3, in which he was coming up off the ground. And in my conversations with Anthony Hudson after the game, he said the explanation from the fourth official was, that they acknowledged that he couldn't do anything about the ball hitting his hand because he was falling to the ground, which seemed to me to be an acknowledgement of ball to hand, but then confirmed the PK anyways, and then ultimately the red card to Axel. So it seems to me now that MLS has a very, very narrow definition of what ball to hand can be, what your hand being in a natural position. I look at the Sporting Kansas City situation against LAFC, where it goes off the defender's thigh and then off of his arm, that was mostly tucked in, and how that would have been different than his arm being just slightly out and then going off of his hand directly rather than off of his body or another deflection. And then I look now whether it was the flick of the ear, and I would say some theatrics from Diego Rossi, or I look at other cases where, you know, even just the slightest headbutt or head touch, you know, is immediately given a red card. There seems to be also another trend I'm seeing is almost zero tolerance for any physical contact of any kind, regardless of intention or severity, above the neck. Your thoughts on Diego Chara red card and the approach that pro is having to this, and really the, you know, what they're directing as far as how they want to officiate the game and what they want soccer and MLS to be like, given the decisions and the trend of those decisions they've made in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think right now you're kind of seeing, like, I don't remember LAFC being as dramatic with their rolling around and, you know, trying to milk foul calls and stuff like that last year. But I think these first two games I've noticed it a lot more, just because I've been watching both of their games straight up. But I think a pro will slowly adjust throughout the year. You kind of do when you see tendencies with teams. As a referee, even doing youth teams and stuff like that. Like, when I was a referee, when I was in high school and early college, I remember there was one team every single time I refereed, this team's game, whether it was an AR or a center referee, like, I knew that his team was going to try certain things. And it was up to me to make sure that they do the things that they were trying were still within the legal parameters of what you can and can't do. And I think slowly pro will get used to that, because I don't think that shouldn't have been a yellow card, a second yellow card to Diego Chara, in my opinion. I thought Rossi made the meal of it. I get it. He's kind of being annoying and flicking his ear, but, like, there's so much worse that happens off the ball, like in a corner kick situation. I mean, how many times do you see guys giving each other's turkey taps? Or, you know, a dude, as he pushes off from a guy, you know, swings down and punches him in the nuts or something like it. Like, there's so many things. Like, Tim Melia went out for a punch to punch a ball the other day, or earlier, or last game against Sporting Kansas City, and it looked like he caught the Philadelphia Union player in the head. I mean, I argue that's more of a yellow card than anything else, than anything Diego Chara did. So, I thought, you know, Rossi made a meal of it and made it, you know, kind of right there in front of Marufo. And, you know, Marufo is probably not going to deal with anything petulant. He's a bit of a stern one, at times. And he has, you know, he kind of has that reputation. So, you know, he's right there. He saw it. You can clearly see Marufo looking right at him as he did it. But it's still, Rossi made a meal of it. I don't think, that really should have been a second yellow card for Chara, but nonetheless, here we are. You know, there's a lot of stuff, though. I think pro, at times has gotten it wrong. There's a couple of calls that go back to the Philadelphia Toronto game in week one. I was questioning some calls there. I don't think the penalty kick for New England yesterday or on Saturday, Zach Steffen ended up saving should never have been called a penalty kick. That was weak. And the fact that he went to VAR or that they didn't even choose to go to VAR to look at it was ridiculous too. And then there's a red card that's given badly in that one that gets called back for a yellow. I think there's a lot of, because, I mean, the referee's right there and he missed it. And then yesterday you have Chris Penso standing right there, and originally chose not to do anything, on the Johnny Russell, Marco Fabian incident. Now whether I think that was, I have a feeling he was just waiting for VAR to come in and say, hey, you need to take a look at this. Because really, and because I don't know if there was nothing there, you know, it's one of those, if you understand the VAR system, you know, he can't go and check to see if that should have been a second yellow card. They can't call that. He can call him into question for a straight red. So, but he can go to the monitor, look at it. And even if he feels it should not have been a straight red, but a yellow, he can still go back and give a yellow, but he can't be prompted to the monitor to go and look and see if that incident itself deserved a yellow card. So it's a way for Pro to kind of, I won't say game the system, but that's a way to ensure that you kind of get the whole situation right. And they did that, and they ended up getting it right in the penalty kicks yesterday. They checked the Gianluca Busio one to see if there was enough contact, and there was definitely enough contact. I don't know why it went to a check, but they decided to check it. But then you have the handball situation on Seth Sinovic yesterday, where he's kind of thrown off balance, but his arm goes up into an insanely unnatural position. I mean, waving your arm above your head is not a natural position for your arm when you're trying to defend a ball in the air. So it hits his hand. It should have been a red card, or it shouldn't have been a red card, but it should have been a penalty kick. They got the call right. So there's a lot of times where Pro's been getting it right, but I think there's still some instances where they haven't gotten the big calls right. And, you know, the little things and the overall management of games, I guess you can make complaints there, but when you miss significantly, when you miss game altering calls like that with the and those calls have the benefit of VAR to help you, you know, VAR's job is there to get it right. So I don't really, I mean, gave a red card in the New England Columbus game. Do I get annoyed that they gave a red card in that? And they choose not to, they go back and look and it's a yellow card. I don't get mad at the referee for getting it wrong in the moment. I get mad at, you know, I'm happy VAR went and got it right because that's what VAR is there to do. But I'm upset in the moment that VAR did not get the New England penalty kick call correct because it shouldn't have been a penalty kick. And I think if he had gone to VAR in that moment, he would have realized, hey, yeah, I got duped. That should not have been a penalty kick. So those are the kind of things that, those are the kind of things that I'd like to see VAR consistently get right is the big calls. I think that's just an overall thing that Pro will get used to. And it's, you know, it's different with the VARs because some of them don't have the same interpretation of what clear and obvious errors are, which is another thing in itself. But, you know, I think so far, from what I've seen last couple weeks, there's been more of the getting the big calls right than there is getting the big calls wrong. And, you know, there's a few that jump out to mind. They're never going to be perfect, but the goal is to minimize those. I just think, you know, you go back to the Chara red card. That's an instance that you can go back and say, man, that probably didn't prompt it. But the problem is VAR in that instance. I don't know if you can review it because it would be reviewing whether or not you should have given him a yellow card, even though it was a total the two yellows equaled the red and it could have been a red card situation. It's confusing. But the question is whether or not they could have done that. And it was probably wrong in real time. Sure, if they go back and look at it at replay, it would have been overturned. But I don't know if they can. So that's the thing that you'd like to see Pro maybe not have to rely on VAR as much, but when they are relying on VAR, nice to see that for the majority so far, it does seem like they are getting the big calls right through VAR. That's my take on it.
I agree with your sentiments that I think MLS officials are maybe on one harsh end of the spectrum, you know, in which, you know, there's just such a narrow definition of what they'll consider to be ball to hand or what they'll consider to be, you know, hand in an unnatural position or even violent conduct in the case of Diego Charaz. But the big thing for me with officials is I would rather have them be consistent and harsh than having them be inconsistent and then, you know, appealing to my definition or I would say a median and average view across world football of what all of those things are. So, you know, has MLS been really harsh on some of these things as we've talked about? Yes, but I would rather have them have no tolerance for the better part of 2 years on any contact above the neck and just have all of that horseplay, chicken-esque stuff just completely come out. There are other ways for you to get under people's skin that doesn't involve you trying to contact somebody's head and things could have gotten end up worse. So in principle, I agree with the decision regarding the Diego Chara second yellow card. If that means that going forward, that just completely stomps out anything of that source to where players are looking to go for something else that's less violent, has less likelihood of escalating, and all of that, I think is a healthier approach for us as a soccer nation and for MLS as a league. So, I think that they have been consistent. I think they're being more consistent. I would personally dial it back if I'm Howard Webb, but I would rather have them get that first part right and be a little bit draconian about things than just be all over the place and then allowing, you know, some of the more, you know, hashtag team chaos in a bad way. Let's move on to pick'ems, Dan. We talked about this last week, but now that we've seen what the MLS teams in CCL this week did over the weekend, just really quickly, who wins and are any of them MLS teams in Tuesday through Thursday this week?
Sporting KC wins 3-1. I think they get through, or at least they get three goals, and they'll get through. They get three goals. They'll win by two at least. I think they'll be fine. Atlanta Monterey is the one that I think could be interesting, but I don't think it'll be enough for Atlanta to overturn. I don't know how well Monterey has played on turf before. It might throw them off a little bit. There's not a whole lot of turf in Liga MX. And then on top of that, I don't necessarily trust. I don't trust Houston on the road in that situation. They're pretty much toast. And New York Red Bulls, maybe, if they get one early and can kind of press them and have, and can kind of get on them. You know, the only thing that New York Red Bulls really have in their favor is the lack of, a midweek or a weekend fixture that Santos Laguna did have to play. So we'll see what happens with the Red Bulls. If there's any of the three that are playing Mexican teams that I think have a real shot at getting out of it, I think New York Red Bulls is the closest. And I still don't think it's above a 33% chance for them to get out of it anyway. So, as the lone MLS team to advance onto the semifinals, but very likely lose to Monterrey.
I've got Sporting Kansas City scoring three goals and getting by, however the math works out. I think that Atlanta will lose by one goal on aggregate. And then obviously the road goals will be massively against them if it ends up being a shootout. And I think Houston and New York Red Bulls will lose by at least four goals total on aggregate, you know, when all things are said and done. Let's move on to the Saturday games. Interesting game that I'm not sure I would have been interested in 2-3 weeks ago, Dan. DC United hosting Real Salt Lake. This will be at 8 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Who you got and why is it the Fighting Wayne Rooneys?
DC United struggled against New York City FC. I guess, well, they struggled to score a goal. Sean Johnson was fantastic, but I think RSL's got a decent back line. They've got a good goalkeeper in Raimondo. They've got a really nice attack, though. I think that's something that NYCFC lacked. I like what I've seen from Baird, Bruce Neck, and Cope. Excuse me, this week. So far this season, the last 2 weeks. So, I'll take a draw here. I'll go 2-2, for some chaos in, Audi Field.
I'm going to say 1-1 in this one. I think it's going to be an interesting back and forth one. I think RSL is positioned to sort of defend a little bit and counter. And I think that they're just going to tee in on Wayne Rooney and try and make somebody else beat them. I think it'll probably be something in the air. Nick Raimondo isn't the tallest guy, and I think they'll try and nick one. I think it'll be a bit of a scrappy game, and maybe RSL end up being lucky, but it'll end up being a 1-1 draw. Moving on to the late night game on Saturday, LA Galaxy hosting Minnesota United. This will be at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, a late one for you East Coasters on ESPN+. Dan, who you got and why, and how dependent is it on Zlatan and Alisson Drini's health?
Yeah, I mean, LA Galaxy probably make this interesting depending on Alisson Drini and Zlatan. I think it provides a little bit more of a problem for the Minnesota backline, but without them, Galaxy look toothless. Minnesota are way better than Dallas. And I wouldn't be shocked if Minnesota win and won. Okay. I'll make two predictions. If Roman Alessandrini and Zlatan play, I'll go 2-1 to Minnesota United. If they do not, I'll go 4-0 to Minnesota United.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm going to do a similar pick. I think if Zlatan and Alessandrini are both able to start and one of them goes 90 and the other one lasts at least 70 minutes, I'll say, 3-2 LA Galaxy. I still don't have a lot of faith in either of these defenses, and I think both offenses are just going to be chomping at the bit, especially if the Galaxy have their stars. I will say if anything less than both of them starting and being able to go 16 minutes, I think that Minnesota probably wins this one 3-1. I'm still not convinced the LA Galaxy if it's their situation defensively, and I'm not sure, especially looking at Chris Pontius and Emma Boateng starting offensively, that they're going to have any teeth at all offensively without Zlatan and Alisson Drini. You know, Sebastian Lletget did hit two posts in that one, so maybe he finds a way to create a goal, but I think Minnesota, unless Darwin Quintero spontaneously combusts before this game kicks off, I know Minnesota's going to go in there and score multiple goals. It's just a matter if the LA Galaxy are going to have the firepower in order to surpass that. Let's move on to the Sunday games, Dan. We'll start with the aforementioned NYCFC and LAFC. They'll be playing at 3 p.m. Eastern on FS1 on the postage stamp at Yankee Stadium. Who you got and why?
I'm going to go with LAFC in this one. I think the postage stamp makes it a little bit more difficult for them, but I still say they win 2-1.
I'm going to say 3-1 in this one. I think the field conditions actually makes it a little bit easier for them, just in the fact that there's a lot less space that they have to go to goal, and generally there's a little bit more chaos in the midfield. So if they're able to get turnovers in a bad situation for the opponent, whether it's Christian Ramirez, Diego Rossi, Adama Diomande, or certainly Carlos Vela, any one of those guys in an even matchup on a counterattack numbers-wise, or in a 1v1 situation, I like them over Sean Johnson and either of the center backs for NYCFC. And other than Maxi Morales, I'm not sure I like any of their offensive options going up against a Walker Zimmerman or Jordan Harvey or anything like that. So I think that matchup will be beneficial to them. I'm still not sure LAFC or NYCFC has figured out their offensive situation, and I know for a fact that LAFC is going to go in there and get multiple goals. Let's move on to the nightcaps. This will be at 5 p.m. Eastern on Fox Sports 1. FC Cincinnati making their home MLS debut against the Portland Timbers on turf at the campus of the University of Cincinnati. Dan, who you got and why?
Well, if Kenny Saif goes 90 minutes, I bet I'll take FC Cincinnati winning 2-1. I don't think there's a whole lot of goals in this one, but I think Cincinnati will get a quote Bailey boost there at Nippert, and it'll be a lot of fun. They'll be out to go. I think a whole lineup for them if they can get at the end of the game. They had Darren Maddox, they had Fernando Adi, they had Kenny Saif and Lama all on the field at the same time. And I thought, hey, there's four attackers on the field at once. And it actually kind of looked good for a second. And Kenny Saif on the left coming, cutting inside and playing that ball to Lama on the overlap there was just a wonderful pass. I think more Kenny Saif means more goals for FC Cincinnati. So Cincinnati, Portland without Diego Chara, if you've ever looked up those stats, it is miserable for Portland without Diego Chara, and their backline is already miserable as it is. So I'll take FC Cincinnati in this one 2-1.
I agree with you. FC Cincinnati, I think after that 1-1 draw at Atlanta, is feeling emboldened. I think they're feeling confident. I would not be shocked at all if it was a complete sellout of Nippert Stadium, and the crowds there an hour early. I think they're going to feel emboldened from the result and coming home to their stadium. And like you said, Dan, the Portland Timbers, I think, are licking their wounds at this point. All it's going to take really, Diego Valeri getting shut down. Kendall Watson will be very familiar with going up against him from their time together in the Western Conference. If they shut down Diego Valeri, I think this could be a romp for FC Cincinnati. I'm going to take 2-1, and I'll say, just for good measure, Fernando Adi getting the game-winning goal against his former team. And let's move on to the last game of the weekend. This will be on Sunday. 5 Sunday MLS games for you folks. Dan, we've got our first Dan-Matt Derby of 2019. Colorado Rapids hosting Sporting Kansas City. This will be at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Plus. A bunch of former Sporting players who I guess have made up Sporting Commerce City for the Rapids, and Sporting Kansas City will obviously be coming off their home CCL game. Who you got and why? And I guess more importantly, I guess the question is, if you had to pick a man of the match amongst former Sporting players wearing burgundy, who are you picking?
I'd pick Kai, probably. If there's anyone who's going to Sporting back line some trouble, I think it'll be Kai. Diego's crafty, but I think Kai, Sporting Kansas City at times tends to struggle with big physical guys, if especially ones that can hold up and create for others. So I don't know. It'll be either Rubio or Kai are probably the two. I dig Benny, but I'm not sure he's the guy for it in this game, especially if he's playing the six, or even any kind of deep midfield role for Colorado. But, this game, I think, is the outcome of this game is dependent on which team Sporting Kansas City plays against Colorado. Do Sporting Kansas City do a little bit of rotation again, for this midweek match against Independiente, and kind of rest maybe one or two of the key starters, for the Colorado match? Or do they just say, you know what, we've got to go all out in this one, you know, the Colorado game be damned. And we'll get to the Colorado game when we get there. With whoever's healthy enough to go. I think that's going to be the interesting one. That's going to be the question there. What lineup does Sporting Kansas City play? I still think Sporting Kansas City is good enough to get some kind of result out of this one. I'll go with a draw in this one. I think it'll be a nice little helter-skelter 2-2 draw here is kind of what I'm predicting. But if Sporting Kansas City rotate the squad or kind of walk through Independiente with some ease and don't have to exert a whole lot, which I don't think will be the case, then I wouldn't be surprised if Sporting Kansas City rolled out a strong group and ended up winning that one. But methinks it'll be a tough game on Thursday for them, and a tough 72-hour turnaround to go back to altitude in Colorado, and what potentially be cold on Sunday. What's that looking like? Is it going to be? Are you guys blizzardy?
No, we're expecting snow and freezing rain on Wednesday. The Rapids have moved their Tuesday and their Wednesday. Training to, I can't remember the name. It starts with a B, but it's the Broncos indoor facility. They were okay. The Broncos indoor facility has both a natural grass field, with the same grass that you have at Mile High, and then also the typical NFL turf. The Rapids were at, were there last week for 2 days, mostly to prepare for playing, on turf at Seattle. But it's just the fact that, you know, they don't want to play on a field that's completely covered in snow if they're not going to get a game that's covered in snow. Anticipated that the field will be cleared up and ready for Sunday. And I think we're looking at a kickoff temperature. It's going to be mid 40s, maybe getting down to close to freezing, by the end of the night. So, it'll be cold temperatures, not anything that these two teams are unfamiliar with. Almost zero precipitation, after Wednesday evening, so it should be a dry, clear night from a sky perspective for the game. I'm gonna go with 2-1 in this one to the Rapids, Dan. I just think that I think Sporting Kansas City is gonna have to go all out in order to advance in Champions League, and we've seen what happens. There's pretty good data of what happens to an MLS team when they play a third game in 8 days, let alone having to play, you know, a fifth or a sixth game in 17 or 20 days or whatever that calendar math ends up being for Sporting Kansas City. I just think they're gonna be dead by the end of the 70th minute. And then, you know, the Rapids, with all the former Sporting players they have, I think are going to be very, very motivated against their opponents. I think Kai Kamara and Diego Rubio both get the two goals for the Rapids in this one. I mean, regardless of what happens, expect some call to go not his way or something to happen that he's not happy. And Benny Failhaber is going to be busting out the salt all over the place, throwing it like it's sea salt, getting ready to get for the roads to get completely iced over. Should be a fun game no matter what. Dan, we got to get out of here. Time for last words. Where can people find you on Twitter, and what do you think of Gideon Salala? I'm signing with Sporting KC.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at SpiritDaniel94. There, shameless plug. You can also see my article on Gideon Zalalem and his recruitment to Sporting Kansas City. You know, I like the signing from a low risk, high reward standpoint. The question is what is his level of play right now? His fitness is there. He has a base of fitness, and he's been training with Arsenal for 6 months. Uninjured, doing fine since his recovery, his official recovery in September. So he just hasn't been able to get games, and he didn't get out on loan for them over the winter spell. You know, he's coming to Kansas City with a good base of fitness, of a week in, week out practicing fitness, but, obviously 90 minutes fit isn't there. And the question is, at what level is he at right now of play? So we'll see how the integration takes, but there it is. It is a 1 year deal with singular options for 2020 and 2021 on the contract. I wouldn't be surprised if one of those at least is exercised, regardless of how this year goes. The guy's talent ceiling is just way too high. You know, Juan Kazin Kamal started off really well last year. And then he has not made another appearance for the first team. I don't know if it's due to ability. There was a whole thing with the Houston Dynamo in the US Open Cup last year where Peter, you know, said some guys he felt like gave up, and we don't do that. And those who gave up will find themselves very, very, very far out from being within the first team again. I don't know if he was one of those, and I don't think it's fair to speculate yet. I mean, I kind of did, so I guess you can kind of speculate and draw conclusions there if you would like. I'm not entirely sold on it yet. I just don't think he's physically ready to play the 6 or 8 consistently at an MLS level. Physically, I mean, he looked fine, and he's good when he gets in there, but I just don't think he's ready for it the way Gianluca Busio is ready for it. So he's still got some seasoning to do, and that's why he's down there. I think they're hoping Zalalem can be that guy behind. You know, so they have Felipe Gutierrez, Kellen Rowe, and Roger Espinoza to rotate between those three. But that means at least one of those guys is going to have to play a back-to-back every which way they go. And Johan Kraaze hasn't looked good in the middle. He's looked better out wide, if anything. So the fact that he can play the sixth potentially to give Elie some respite and is also very comfortable as a number 8, and the midfield fits perfectly into Sporting Kansas City's system. Like I said, the question is, what is his playing level? I think we'll see that in the coming weeks. But overall, it's a good move by Peter Ramiz. There was no transfer fee. All it was a contract negotiation between the player and the club. Brian Bliss loves him, has coached him, was part of the technical staff for the USU 20s, has been through multiple cycles with Gideon Zalalem and knows what he's getting. And so far, with all the signings that Sporting Kansas City have made recently and how well they've assimilated, my money's on Brian Bliss knowing who he's bringing into the team and knowing they're, so, I assume Zalalem will work out well, but the deal itself, low risk, high reward potential there, and I really wouldn't expect anything less from Sporting Kansas City and Peter Ramiz on that front. So I like the move. Again, you can find me on Twitter at SperryDaniel94. I will be at the CCL match on Thursday. It is going to be a lot of fun this week with some good midweek CCL action and then some great MLS action over the weekend. So give me a follow. Hit it up on Twitter, and we would love to debate whether or not Minnesota United is a playoff team with you.
Well said, Dan. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Check out our content at LastWordOnSoccer.com and at LastWordSC across all the socials. You can subscribe to Last Word Soccer Club Radio wherever you get your podcasts. Just search LWS Radio. You'll find us and a whole bunch of other great stuff that the Last Word family puts out. Thank you to our sponsor, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or team at RoughneckScarves.com. That does it all for us for this week, folks. We'll see you next week, probably doing some postmortem on CCL and talking about whatever noteworthy topics happen over the weekend. We'll see you then.